What's the Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The Russian ambassador to Turkey was shot and killed Monday as he delivered remarks at an art exhibition in Ankara. The gunman and off-duty policeman opened fire at close range, killing Ambassador Andrei Karlov. Associated Press photographer Burhan Ozbilitsi was an eyewitness.
I saw immediately Russian ambassador on the ground, on the floor. We could not check if he was lifeless, dead, or simply injured. And the man continued to speak, and he warned people to go away or to leave.
The 22-year-old assassin, who himself was killed, yelled, "Don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria, and Allahu Akbar." Three others were wounded. Russian President Vladimir Putin condemned the killing as an act of terrorism aimed at undermining bilateral efforts to resolve the Syrian conflict. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but one Turkish official said there are strong signs the gunman was a follower of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, accused of orchestrating last year's attempted coup. The cleric denied any involvement. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned Monday of an impending genocide unfolding in South Sudan unless action is taken, while renewing his call for an arms embargo.
Reports suggested that President Salva Kiir and his loyalists are contemplating a new military offensive in the coming days against the SPLM in opposition. Moreover, there are clear indications that Riek Machar and other opposition groups are pursuing a military escalation.
A political dispute between the two, later formed a rebel force, erupted into conflict in December 2013, leaving tens of thousands dead, millions displaced. A shaky ceasefire was reached in August. This is VOA News. A truck plowed into a crowded Christmas market in Berlin late Monday, killing at least 12, injuring dozens. British tourist Mike Fox was on the scene near the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church.
I spoke to two people who were lying on the floor with broken limbs, but they were going to be okay. I saw one guy being dragged away with blood on his face.
Police have the suspected driver in custody. Another passenger of the truck died and is described as a Polish national. The motive for the attack remains unclear. Republican Donald Trump has been officially elected the 45th U.S. president, his victory confirmed Monday by the required vote of the Electoral College. Mr. Trump surpassed the 270 votes out of 538 cast needed to win. While his opponent, Democrat Hillary Clinton, won the popular vote, the election is won in each of the 50 states and District of Columbia. The Congress will certify the outcome January 6th, Mr. Trump to be sworn into office January 20th. Thousands have been evacuated from the devastated Syrian city Aleppo, along with two rebel-besieged northwest towns. The arrangement worked out with the Syrian government by Russia and Turkey proceeds as the UN Security Council approved the presence of UN monitors to oversee the evacuations. Samantha Powers, the U.S. UN ambassador.
Today's resolution, I think, is significant in the sense that at least we now have the council finally agreeing that people who want to leave eastern Aleppo should be able to be monitored by the United Nations, the ICRC, the Syrian Red Crescent, and others.
Meanwhile, UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura expressed optimism the UN will arrange new political talks in Geneva February 8th. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has been convicted of negligence by a French court for failing to challenge hundreds of millions in payouts to a state arbitration panel made to a business tycoon. The case comes from action she took when she was France's finance minister. She will not pay a fine and not serve prison time. The African Union force in Somalia said its soldiers killed six passengers at a minibus that refused to stop at a checkpoint. A traditional elder says AMISOM forces opened fire on the vehicle in Lower Shabelle region Sunday. Talks between the U.S. and China continue on gaining the return of an unmanned underwater drone Beijing seized in the South China Sea last week. Peter Cook, a U.S. defense spokesman.
This is the first time we've had an incident like this with the Chinese Navy, to my knowledge, and obviously this is a situation that we had concern with as to how this played out. This was an underwater vehicle doing something that we've done before. It's an unclassified program. We want the vehicle back, and we're working to arrange that.
He said the UUV was seized illegally by the Chinese Navy. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan says there is no need for an UN arms embargo against the country.
Arms embargo will significantly reduce the ability of South Sudan to be a sovereign country because it will make South Sudan weak and susceptible to an outside invasion.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Nigeria denies mass burials of a church that collapsed earlier this month. The Committee to Protect Journalists says six journalists were killed in Africa this year, and Mali says it will not help the European Union to identify and return illegal Malians.
The President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, President of the Republic du Mali, accorded a plus grande importance à la sécurisation.
He said the question of Malian migrants and refugees is a matter of the heart to the President and himself.
That's VOA Katerina Hoya in Bamako. The children of Ketwa in Uganda find inspiration and hope. And many undocumented immigrants in the U.S. fear President-elect Donald Trump will make good on his campaign promise to deport them. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's government says any arms embargo would significantly reduce the country's ability to be a sovereign nation. This comes as the United States is pushing the United Nations Security Council to pass an arms embargo resolution before the end of this year. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, said Monday that the situation in South Sudan is not getting better but worse. Also, in a statement Monday, State Department spokesman John Kirby called on all parties in South Sudan to bring peace to the people of South Sudan. Atain Wek Atain, the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, says it will be very unfortunate for the United States, which helped to bring about South Sudan's independence, to now want to kill the country with an arms embargo.
It will be extremely unfortunate for a country like United States of America, who helped to midwife South Sudan, to also try desperately to kill the same child it has helped some 5 years ago to come to being, now wanted to make sure that it destroyed South Sudan. Because arms embargo will significantly reduce the ability of South Sudan to be a sovereign country, because it will make South Sudan weak and susceptible to an outside invasion.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Powell, has said that the situation in your country is not getting better. In addition, your government and perhaps the Riek Machar rebels, you are getting ready for more war.
No, well, this is not true. With my respect to the United States ambassador to United Nations, the information she's actually talking about is not correct, because she might have got information from those who wanted to see South Sudan, you know, becoming weaker and weaker, those who have hidden agenda. Otherwise, there's no preparation for war, because the government of South Sudan is fighting nobody. The main rebel group that the South Sudan government was fighting since 2013 signed peace agreement, and they are now fully implementing peace agreement under the leadership of President Salva Kiir Mayardit and General Taban Dengai. And therefore, the fear of more fighting in South Sudan, or what they call looming genocide, are just utopian. And these are just the making of those who wanted to raise funds and try to seek job in South Sudan.
According to the draft resolution which Ambassador Powell is pushing, there is a part of it that will impose sanctions on your Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, and a rebel general. This is a serious matter now.
No, this is, to tell you very clear, they are just victimizing the Minister of Information, and they are even victimizing those individuals chosen to be a target, you know, of sanction. These people, including Minister of Information, they are like any other Minister of Information in the world, you know, trying to do their legitimate part of collective responsibility. And not more than that, they are not feeling war. They are just defending the legitimacy of the government, and therefore targeting them is targeting South Sudan, because they have not done anything that would actually be seen to be fueling war. The opposite is true. These people are the ones who want South Sudan to survive.
So you don't believe that South Sudan is headed towards a possible genocide, because the purpose of the arms embargo, according to Ambassador Powell, is to reduce the possibility of a genocide in your country?
I don't think that the intelligence of Ambassador Samantha Powers has reduced not to to realize that genocides are not committed by using firearms. The Rwandan genocide in 1994 did not use a single shot, but yet they killed nearly 1 million using machetes, you know, knives and spears, you know, and then South Sudan has a significant number of those weapons that can affect if genocide is needed. But I don't think there is anybody who needs genocide, because we are brothers and sisters. We have lived far enough before any foreigner coming to our country.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The government of Mali says Monday it will not help the European Union to identify and return illegal Malian migrants to Mali. Ongoing talks on the issue are part of larger efforts by the EU to try to curb migration via cooperation with key countries of origin, a strategy that resulted in a multi-million dollar deal with Niger earlier this month. Katerina Hoyer reports from Bamako.
In Mali, negotiations on facilitating migrant returns have caused a stir, following terms of the proposed deal detailing the presence of civil servants in Europe to help authorities there identify Malians there illegally. The government's main concern is the safety and well-being of Malians abroad, Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop told reporters in Bamako on Monday.
Le président Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, président de la République du Mali, accorde la plus grande importance à la sécurisation.
He said the question of Malian migrants and refugees is a matter of the heart to the president and himself. He also said civil servants traveling to Europe to identify migrants who have had their asylum requests rejected is out of the question at the moment. The EU is currently negotiating a $116 million deal with Mali to expedite the return of migrants to the African country. The talks cover a number of areas, including providing the funds to help job creation and assistance in fighting people smuggling to prevent Malians from heading to Europe. The negotiations are the most detailed yet between Brussels and an African country.
Je le dis, je le répète, aucun accord n'a été signé avec l'Union européenne, ni accord de réadmission.
Diop said no deal has been reached and that negotiations will continue. He said any deportations of Malian citizens from the EU needs to be conducted with respect for human rights. The two parties will also work to create jobs for young Malians, while Malian authorities plan to issue identity cards and biometric passports to help track migrants. So far, the EU has reached agreements with a handful of African countries, including Sudan and Mali's neighbour Niger. EU border agency Frontex has estimated that more than 10,000 Malians have entered the bloc since the start of 2015. This month, Algeria rounded up and deported 260 Malians. Katerina Hayek for VOA News, Bamako.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 20th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Listen, shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brila FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. Rumors of a mass burial for victims of the Reynolds Bible Church roof that collapsed earlier this month in the Nigerian city of Uyo have been dismissed by the Akwa Ibom state government. Nevertheless, families continue to demand the government hand over the bodies of their loved ones for a proper burial. Dixon Salami Adama has more on the story from Uyo, Nigeria.
The city of Uyo continues to reel in the aftermath of the church collapse tragedy as the families of the victims demand the bodies of their loved ones and ask who will pay for the expensive burial ritual according to customs. Since the statement by the president of the Council for the Regulation of Engineering in Nigeria accusing authorities of ignoring several pleas to stop church constructions due to structural damages, the families looked at the government as the responsible party. The burial ceremony in this part of the world is a very expensive affair, and most families cannot afford it and are looking at the government or the church to pay. Meanwhile, the government said it took care of the medical bills for the injured, spending millions of naira but kept a tight lip on the funeral bills. Professor Chris Ekong of University of Uyo lost his younger brother, Dr. Siri Ekong.
There is no clear statement or indication from government how we are going to get our corpses out. Because government is saying, putting it on the police, that the police must do so. The police must tell them what they have to do before they release the corpse. And police is also waiting for government. So I think there's some game that I don't understand. We are not also very clear whether government will pick the bills for the mortuary bills, for instance, because there's no clear communication to families. We've gone to the mortuary, we've identified our brother, we've signed some papers for identification, but there is virtually no communication. But nobody's talking to anybody. Because I had expected by now government should have had a press conference to talk to families. Government must be open. They have to tell us what you will do and what you cannot do.
The State Commissioner of Health, Dr. Dominic Ukpong, confirmed to the media that the state government officials have been humiliated by family members who stormed the hospitals demanding to receive the bodies of their dead relatives. The state government assured the families that they will release the bodies after the investigation concludes. Ukpong said that this decision by the government was in line with standard practice. Dennis Udoma, chairman of the Akwa Ibom State Correspondent Chapel of the Nigerian Union of Journalists, explained.
I don't think government has that intention for mass burial of the victims because the dead bodies have been identified by their families. Talking about who should bear the cost for the funeral, I think it would be right, it would be appropriate for government to do something about the burial since it has already taken full responsibility for those that have been wounded in the disaster. So it would be right for the government to equally extend such gesture to the bereaved families for those ones who have died in the process.
Raphael Edem, Special Advisor on Public Affairs to Governor Udom Emmanuel of Akwa Ibom State, defended the state government's decision.
Certain steps, there are certain procedures that need to actually be taken before the corpses are released. But of course, they will be released because, of course, there's no need keeping them. There's no need keeping them. And the victims, the remains of the people who passed on, unfortunately, belong to the families. So at the appropriate time, when what needs to be done has been done, I am sure that will be released. Of course, there's absolutely no truth whatsoever in the rumor that there's going to be a mass burial. There will be no mass burial. Those corpses would be identified. Some of them already have been, if not all of them. And the people who should claim them would be properly verified. And then the remains will return to the families for burial. Now, from a personal point of view, too many people look at this issue from a government point of view. That incident could have happened anywhere else. Could have happened anywhere else in the state. It could have happened without the governor in attendance. And governments would still have responded in the way that they are responding. Because it's the duty of government to respond at times like this, everywhere across the world, responding to an emergency, responding to this kind of unprecedented incident. So we're doing the best we can, and we're really hoping that by the time the commission finishes its work, many of the unanswered questions now, there will be answers to such questions.
Despite the many assurances by the state officials that the deceased will be returned to the families and the government will be there, families remain anguished. It remains to be seen who pays for the funeral bills and how the victims are eventually buried. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says Africa this year has seen a fall in killings, but a rise in the number of jailed journalists, a trend that is echoed worldwide. In East Africa, 3 of the 6 journalists killed this year are from Somalia, and the overwhelming majority of jailed journalists are in Ethiopia and Eritrea. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg on Africa's year in journalism.
2016 has been a grim year for African journalism, with 6 journalists killed and 41 languishing in prisons across sub-Saharan Africa, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. In 2015, 14 journalists were killed and 34 were in jail in Africa. Worldwide, at least 48 journalists were killed this year, many of them in the conflict zones of Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, and Afghanistan. And 90% were local journalists. Worldwide, there are 259 imprisoned journalists, the highest figure CPJ has documented in at least 16 years of record-keeping. The deadliest African nation for journalists was Somalia, with three journalists killed in a troubled coastal nation that has not had a stable central government for more than two decades. And of the 41 jailed journalists, 33 are in the neighboring countries of Ethiopia and Eritrea, two nations whose governments have been accused of becoming increasingly intolerant of the press amid growing dissatisfaction with their long rule. The director of Johannesburg-based Media Monitoring Africa, William Byrd, says the arrests of the half-dozen Ethiopian journalists run parallel to the rise of anti-government protests. Five of the journalists are being held without charge, and all five had reported critically on the protests.
We've seen, certainly in 2016, significant levels of civil uprising to challenge the lack of freedoms there, and part of the government's default response has been to arrest and detain journalists. They've clearly taken an approach that says the best way of staying in power is to make sure that you crush anyone who opposes you.
In Somalia, former radio journalist Mohamed Ibrahim Mwalimu, who is Secretary General of the National Union of Somali Journalists, says killings in his country are mercifully lower than last year. But, he says, that could be because so many journalists have already been killed. He counted at least two dozen that he could remember, or fled into exile, or been driven to self-censor. Mwalimu lives in Mogadishu, but spoke to VOA via Skype from Nairobi, where he is attending a journalism workshop.
Some of our colleagues went to other parts of the world, and they fled from Somalia because of their own security. So that's what they want. That's what all those people who want to silence the media wanted.
He says he has had two close calls, most recently in January of last year, when he had to play dead to avoid being killed as militants sorted among a heap of fallen bodies and fired bullets into those who appeared to still be alive.
If we all leave and run away from Somalia, that's what these people who want to silence the media want. So we are actually insisting that until the last drop of our blood, we will remain in Somalia and will work. But we still wanted to die for our people because our people deserve to listen and hear what the reality on the ground is.
The six journalists killed in Africa in 2016 covered conflict, corruption, and politics. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
An unlikely chess club in the slums of Kampala became a global powerhouse, and the inspiring story of a club's founder and members became a book and a movie. Faisal Al-Mazri has more on how Queen of Kitwe, the movie, is helping the kids of Kitwe, the slum. Fifth Lapidus Nine Reads.
Robert Katende started this chess program 14 years ago for children with disabilities in Kampala. Now it attracts hundreds of kids in 300 locations across Uganda.
I never imagined what it has turned out to be, for sure, because all what I was looking at was to see how best I would be able to empower these kids, to help them realize their full potential.
Queen of Katwe, the new movie from Disney, tells the story of Katende's chess clubs and Fiona Mutesi, the young girl who became a world chess champion despite her modest background. The film is set in the overcrowded slum of Katwe in the Ugandan capital, where Katende wanted to be a football coach for disadvantaged kids. But he noticed they weren't that interested in playing sports, so he decided to teach them chess instead. He started out with a team of five boys, whom he called the Pioneers. Fiona Mutesi joined later, and in a few years, the team was traveling around the world to represent Uganda in international competitions. Richard Tugumi is one of the original pioneers.
The film, I think it's actually making a lot, transforming a lot of lives of the people in Katwe, because personally I believe now that it doesn't matter wherever you come from, because people here come from slums, but whoever will watch that movie will be able to know that there is life outside Katwe.
During the movie premiere in Kampala, the local actors shared the limelight with stars like British-Nigerian actor David Oyelowo, who plays Katende.
It was invaluable shooting in Katwe because it's such a specific place. And that's what I love about the film. What I loved about the script is its specificity. It wasn't just a general African country. This wasn't just a general depiction of a girl's life.
The experience of living in poverty is familiar to many of the film's Ugandan actors. Medina Nalwanga, who plays Fiona, used to sell corn as a child. Martin Kabanza, who plays her brother Brian, was also a child street vendor.
I used to walk around on the streets with shoes, selling them with my father, which I think it's somehow related to what I was doing in the movie. So I was like doing my real story.
And the movie, for the most part, sticks to that real amazing story of believing in yourself. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Illegal immigration was a signature theme during Donald Trump's presidential campaign. He promised supporters he would build a wall around the U.S.-Mexico border and deport the estimated 11 million immigrants who are in the United States illegally. Now that Trump is president-elect, many undocumented immigrants fear he will make good on those promises and deport them. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
During his campaign, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump left little room for doubt about his policy intentions regarding the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants now living in the U.S. Trump said this at a rally last fall.
For those here illegally today who are seeking legal status, they will have one route and one route only: to return home and apply for re-entry like everybody else. We will break the cycle of amnesty and illegal immigration.
This rhetoric struck a chord for attorney Anand Ahuja, co-founder of Indian Americans for Trump. He waited 9 years in India to be permitted to enter the U.S. legally and become a citizen. He resents those who come to the U.S. through what he calls the back door and who then get to stay on.
Somebody has entered into this country illegally, has broken the laws. They all should be deported.
Cab driver Mamadou Ouattara came to the U.S. from the Ivory Coast 16 years ago. Today, he is a U.S. citizen. While Ouattara considers himself grateful to be an American, he fears for his friends in New York's African diaspora. Many lack any immigration documents at all.
They have to hide to work because they have family, wife, children. So what they're going to do? So they have to hide themselves, do some job in some type of darkness and get underpaid. They don't have any choice. The policy I saw during the campaign, I'm really scared.
Sion Girma is an Ethiopian-American immigration attorney with the African Services Committee in Harlem. Recently, she has noticed a change in what she calls the emotional temperature among her clients.
Particularly for the black immigrants that we serve, the realities of being black, which is, you know, experiencing discrimination in various forms, the multiple stresses that impact their mental well-being, is now being compounded with the realities of being an immigrant in a very, like, anti-immigrant moment and political environment in the U.S. Particularly for African immigrants coming from majority Muslim nations, they're dealing now with the additional pressures of worrying about increased enforcement and expansion of mass deportation and detention.
The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, or DACA program, which President Obama authorized in 2012, was one potential pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. It offered renewable two-year work visas and protection from deportation to people who were under 16 when their undocumented parents came to the U.S. These are tough times for DACA recipient Francis Mati.
We don't know what to expect from the new incoming president, but we do know that throughout his campaign, he several times said that he would end all the immigration executive actions that President Obama made. At the same time, we're going to fight back because we know this is our country.
When Donald Trump assumes the presidency January 20th, he will have many choices concerning how far and how quickly he wishes to enact his campaign promises to get tough on illegal immigrants by rounding up and deporting them. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Gunfire could be heard in Congo's capital, Kinshasa, early Tuesday morning after the mandate for President Joseph Kabila passed without the president stepping down and with no elections in sight. Kabila's mandate ended at midnight Monday following his 2 terms in office. A presidential advisor, Banama Kikaya, said it was unconstitutional to demand that Kabila leave office at midnight. And that's it for this Tuesday, December 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.